The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Our tech team ensure your broadband runs at its optimum speed. It's all part of the service.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so to this week, mum of three, Niamh, spoke to me about the pressure facing parents all over the country as she tries to balance homeschooling alongside long shifts working as a nurse on a busy hospital ward. Philomena Lee, whose experience in Shanross Abbey mother and baby home was brought to the screen in the award-winning film Philomena, spoke to me on the day the Commission's report revealed the scale of abuse at the centre of Ireland's mother and baby homes. Wilfred Frost is the son of legendary television host David Frost, and he talked to me about rediscovering his father's long-lost tapes and exploring them in his podcast series, The Frost Tapes. And Dr. Caro Verbeek is an art and scent historian based in the Netherlands. She told me about her unique and fascinating work keeping history alive by reconstructing the smells of the past. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy. Let's say good morning to Niamh. How are you, Niamh?
Morning, Ryan. How are you?
Nice to talk to you today.
You too.
I was talking last week and we were talking about, you know, how's everyone doing? And you wrote this email into us and we thought, I don't want to read it. I want to talk to you if that's okay. Why did you write to us?
Well, I had heard that mum who had emailed you on Friday morning at 4 a.m. from her kitchen table about, I think she had two children with autism. Mm-hmm. And it just resonated and I just said, well, sure, look, you're saying all week, write in. So I did.
Good on you.
And I didn't even sign it. I actually just sent it. I don't even know what I was thinking. I kind of rambled a bit in it. Mm. But I was talking about, I have three boys. I have Daniel, who was 11 just before Christmas. Paul is nine. He was nine in December. And then I have Luke, who's 5.5.
Okay.
So we're back to homeschooling.
To know what time we are now, we are at 9:37. What time does homeschooling begin? Because I don't have necessarily homeschooling as such, and that I don't have to do it because the kids are of a certain age.
Yeah.
Tell me about what happens this morning, for example.
So, well, the emails were coming kind of from Friday, preparing us for today. We got the breakdown of their week's plans yesterday, and Paul was, my nine-year-old had a class meeting there at 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
So he had to be up and ready for 9 o'clock. So they're having small class meetings twice a week this week. My bigger two boys, just 10 minutes for the teacher to kind of tell them about the week ahead.
Okay.
And then we'll plough on at the kitchen table.
So who sits around? Here's what I wanted to do for me, Niamh. Would you mind?
Yeah.
There are a lot of people listening this morning who don't have homeschooling in their lives at all.
Yeah.
And a lot of people listening this morning who are hearing a lot about, oh, homeschooling. But it makes no sense until we understand what it means for somebody like you, for example. So give us the morning, which you see coming down the tracks every morning for in your life, starting at what time?
So well, we're up, Luke is generally up around 7, the youngest. So we're up and breakfast and getting everybody ready. And then my husband working from home. So he's in Daniel's bedroom, which kind of excludes that for Daniel to do his homework. So that brings everybody downstairs. So I've decided this time with Daniel and Paul, the two bigger boys, I'm going to do their work in the morning. So now Daniel's pretty independent. He's in fifth class, so he doesn't need much input. But Paul needs that extra little bit of support, my nine-year-old. So I'm going to have the two of them do their homework at the kitchen table. I'll be there in the kitchen. I'll be there at the table if they need me. And then my youngest, Luke, is 5.5. He started junior infants this year, so we didn't have homeschooling for him in the last lockdown because he was still in play school. But he has extra needs. He's autism and he's extra bits going on. So there is my biggest challenge.
Okay, autism covers so much. And you hear the word spectrum, Niamh, as you know. Can you tell us, can you place, roughly speaking, and I say, ask that respectfully, tell me where Luke is at.
So Luke, kind of, I picked things up in him at around 2.5, 3. And it all kind of came to a head 2 years ago when he went to play school because his behaviours at home were very impulsive. They were quite aggressive. There would be meltdowns. There would be spontaneous hitting and biting of the older two boys, myself and my husband, for like the smallest of reasons. You could have cut his toast wrong. you know, silly little things like that. They're just unexplained. So his behaviour has been quite challenging. So during the last lockdown, it was very difficult. He was still quite challenging. All services stopped. Occupational therapy stopped. There was no speech therapy. Play school stopped. All those things that kind of gave a bit of respite, if I'm honest, for me to be able to cope with him as the day went on. Mm-hmm. So we were all then at home. So when they went back to school, I actually found the last lockdown much easier. I know a lot of people found it quite difficult. But because they were in school, it was definitely much easier. Occupational therapy had restarted for him, and that makes a huge difference for him. So his behaviour at the moment isn't quite as challenging as it was, but his concentration levels are deplorable. I'm dreading how I'm going to get to sit him to focus for a few minutes even today. But I'll try.
Oh, you will try, because that's what you do. Exactly.
Yeah.
So you've got Paul and Daniel at the kitchen table.
Yes.
You've got your husband is in Paul's room trying to hold down a job. I'm trying to keep up here. It's like the Brady Bunch gone mad on COVID.
Elizabeth,
okay. And then we've got Luke. Where does Luke go when the other boys are in the kitchen with you?
So I have to be honest, Luke will be either watching TV or a tablet.
Tell me about the tablet.
So he might watch a bit of Paw Patrol. It just keeps him away from the boys and gives the boys some peace to do their work.
Okay, so you need to throw him a bone as such just to say, just please
just
don't
us,
be at
yeah.
it. Okay,
yeah.
Next question, because I'm trying to get a day in the life of a homeschooler in January 2021.
Yeah.
The way you're talking, it strikes me like you're a stay-at-home mum.
No.
That couldn't be further from the truth.
I'm not. I'm a nurse. I'm a frontliner. I work on a transplant unit, bone marrow transplant unit in James's. I was working all weekend. I'm working tonight.
What's your shift?
They're 12 and a half hour shifts. So a day shift is 7:30 in the morning till 8 p.m. and a night shift is 7:30 p.m. to 8 a.m.
What time do you start work tonight?
I'm working tonight, yeah.
At what time?
Tonight. I'll be in for 7:30 tonight.
At what time does school finish at?
Well, I'm hoping school will be finished by lunchtime, is my plan.
And what do you do at lunchtime?
So myself and Paddy were just talking about this morning. I'm going to try and lie down at lunchtime, is my plan. Because when they're in school and I'm working a night shift, I come back after I bring them to school and I go back to bed until I have to pick Luke up at 1:30. So I get those few hours, which is why the last lockdown there, kind of after they went back to school, was so much easier, because I could get some rest before I go into work. So I'm going to try and lie down at lunchtime for an hour or so, and then it'll be into work tonight.
You were working last... I'm trying to keep up. Forgive
no,
me.
No. I worked days over the weekend. Yeah, I worked days this weekend.
7:30 to 8 p.m.?
Yeah, both days. Yeah.
And what... Does Paddy mind the kids then for that?
Yeah.
When you're doing that shift for the...
Yeah.
You come home at 8 p.m. How tired are you? Not alone are you tired. How tired are you?
Oh, you're exhausted.
It must be a different level, is it?
It is a different level. And it's terrible to say, but you kind of get used to it. You know, I've been doing them for, 20-odd years now at this stage, and I've always done the long shifts. So I'm used to it. But, you know, gone are the days when you had no children. You could just come home and flake out and then sleep half the day the next day. Those days are so long gone.
Bring me to 9:45 now. Bring me to lunchtime today when the school as such ends.
Yeah.
And you're kind of gearing up for your shift at 7:30. There's dinner on the way at some stage.
Yeah.
Not to mention lunch. Where do you go for your lunch?
We just have lunch here at the kitchen table.
Where do you go for your lunch? Where do you go for your sleep? I meant to ask. Do you go to your own
upstairs.
Bed?
I'll come upstairs to my own bed. Yeah.
Right. Kids smell weakness.
Oh, totally.
And if you're tired and you want to go to bed, that's when they want to come and talk to you. Or bounce on the bed, or act the maggot.
Particularly a 5.5-year-old.
Now,
yes.
How realistic is your prospect of getting a sleep at lunchtime?
It's very minimal, very minimal. But if I can even just chill out and, you know, just even lie down for an hour, that can help, you know. And then in the last lockdown, the original one last March and April, everybody was so nervous and... Mm. I was nervous going into the hospital. I was nervous of bringing something in there because our patients are so vulnerable. I was nervous of bringing something home to the house. We didn't see my mum, who lives on her own. So then the kind of the support bubbles came about. So we have mum in our support bubble now. So for this lockdown, I am sleeping in mum's house tomorrow after my night shift, because I just got no sleep after night shift the last time, because like that, Luke could smell you nearly and he'd be in on top of you. And it could be 11 o'clock. You could be in a deep sleep. You know, you go to bed at around 8:30, 9:00. Yeah. He could be in at 11 o'clock jumping on you. So I'm going to sleep in my mum's now this time around. After the night shift.
I understand. Yeah. Do you know what? I almost feel slightly relieved that you're going to your mother's house, because I'm exhausted talking to you. I can feel the tiredness. You have the most relentless routine I've heard. It's full on.
Yeah, it is full on. But I'm not the only one. All the girls I work with, we're all at it.
That's why I'm so happy to talk to you today, because as I was asking last week, how are you all doing? This is so important to get for us as fellow citizens of yours.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about the front line and then we all go off to the shops to buy the papers. And by that I mean me. When we're told to stay at home. You know, I feel a little bit guilty talking to you, actually.
I don't feel guilty.
No, but you know what I mean? People are kind of going, oh, but we need to get out and we need to do stuff and we need to, you know, get in the cars and do everything like that. And yet I'm talking to you and I'm thinking, like, when you're in the hospital that you describe yourself in, are you in the full PPE sort of armour that we hear about?
We're not in the full yellow gowns unless somebody is query COVID. So our ward is quite protected. And we're the bone marrow transplant unit, so our patients are extremely vulnerable. They have, like, no immune system. So kind of infection control is our bread and butter. We do it every day, all year, every year. So we've had to step it up a gear. The last few winters, like during the flu seasons, we've kind of put on masks going into patients anyway. So we were just about to get rid of the masks last February, and then COVID was on the way. So we've been wearing masks in work for a year and a half solid now. But on top of that, we wear visors going into all our patients now. So we've the mask, the visors, we put on gowns, we wash our hands going in, wash hands coming out, gloves, doing everything. It's a busy unit.
So you'd wear masks for how many hours?
Everything, 12 and a half hours. We wear them all day. We only take them off to literally eat our food and we put them back on us for the rest of our break.
So when you get home then, do you have to do all that kind of decontamination with your clothes?
Yeah, well, I just go straight to the shower. I nearly have a uniform that I wear into work. Do you know, I wear the same clothes into work every shift. Yeah. And you just throw them in the machine when you come home. We don't wear our uniforms into work. We change in work, obviously. Yeah. And then I just jump straight in the shower. Even the Daniel and Paul now, they don't come near me. And they go and have your shower, Mom. I'm like, I'm going.
How are you?
I'm okay.
Yeah.
I'm okay. I had a bit of a wobble last week, I have to admit.
Yeah.
I mean, we kind of knew this was going to come. We could see the numbers rising. We knew with the movement there before Christmas and over Christmas that I kind of thought there'd be a lockdown. I didn't initially think the schools would close, and then obviously the numbers just went astronomical. So it was kind of inevitable. But then last Monday, I did have a wobble. I was like, I can't do this again. I can't.
What does a wobble look like?
Oh, lots of tears, generally. Now, I'm a crier anyway. People who know me will laugh because I am a crier. But, yeah, and I, you know, during the first lockdown, it was very difficult, it was very stressful. I don't feel as stressed now. I've kind of got my head back in the game now. But I did have a wobble last month. I can't go back to this again.
And can I ask you, how do you de-wobble?
I do lots of walking.
Yeah.
And I have the crack with the girls in work because they're all mental. We've a great bunch. We've a great bunch in work. I have great friends and great family. My mom is brilliant. My brother lives close by. He has three little girls who are close in age to my three boys, but we haven't seen a whole lot of them, unfortunately.
You know, so, Luke, I'd say, takes up a lot of your time.
He does, yes.
And a lot of your heart and a lot of your attention.
Yeah.
What about the other boys? I mean, you know, a lot of attention can often go to the child who has the needs, but everyone has needs.
Everybody has needs. So I was just thinking about this actually the other day. Like, we did a lot before lockdown. There was a lot of kind of splitting up and dividing. So either I would do something with the two big boys and Paddy would take Luke, or vice versa, just to give everybody a breather. But actually lockdown has kind of forced us all to be together again. And like, you couldn't bring me to the cinema. So Paddy might have brought the boys to the cinema, or I would have, or we even tried to go to the fish place in Bray, the aquarium in Bray, and Luke wouldn't. He freaked out going in there. So Paddy had to bring the boys in there on his own. So because of lockdown now, not very much is open. We're all together. And Luke loves, we've Marley Park here on our doorstep in St. Andrew's Park. He loves both those parks. And he loves the mountains and he loves forests. So we do all that. And actually the bigger two love jumping on rocks and, you know, so we kind of do all that together. But I've, on my walks in the evening times, Daniel has started coming with me on my walks now. And we have the chat. And it's actually lovely having that time. I was like, I can't believe you're big enough now to come out with me at night time on a walk. It's lovely.
So
kind of spending time with them separately, but doing more together. I feel we're doing more together than what we had been before lockdown, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. Great sense. Yeah. Text says, I can totally feel what Niamh is going through at the moment. I'm about to start trying to homeschool three children. Also, one has additional needs. And I'm a nurse. And I need an IT degree to upload this seesaw that and the other platforms. Yeah. My life is a seesaw at the moment, up and down and up and down. And gosh, that sums it all up in some strange ways. Lots of people saying, if they need to watch the tablet, let them watch the bloody tablet.
Yeah,
don't be overthinking it. And don't, you know, it's a pandemic. The rules aren't the same.
They're not.
Okay, so don't be beating yourself up. How do you feel about level five as it stands?
Level five as it stands.
This level five.
Like, I really didn't think we'd be back here again, but here we are.
Do you think it's strong enough?
God, can we go much stronger? I don't know. Like, we're kind of 2 weeks post Christmas now, 2.5 weeks post Christmas. So we were talking about this in work yesterday. We were like, maybe another 10 days it might plateau out, you know, and we might see beginnings of a turnaround, but the numbers are so high this time. You know, they've never been as high as this. But we've done it before. We can do it again. I'm an optimist. We can do it again. Yeah. We can turn it around. The vaccine is here. Myself and the girls in the ward, most of us have had the vaccine now because we work with the vulnerable
that's good news.
Patient group. So they started there on the 30th. I had mine on the 31st, so I get the booster on Thursday week. So yeah, a lot of us have had it. So there's definitely hope. I think if we just stick to the advice, to the public health advice, the guidelines, we can turn it around. We can get the schools open again. And maybe this will all be a distant memory in a while.
You know it will.
It has to be.
And it will be. Yeah. But you are remarkable. And I'm sure you know. You don't need to hear it from me. But I'm just so taken aback. But no, honestly, Niamh, I mean it. You and your husband and the boys.
You
represent so many families around the country who are, as that person says, seesaw.
Absolutely.
I have this kind of strange list that I haven't kind of formulated properly of people I'm dying to meet when this is over and to invite them into the Late Late Show audience as my special guests. And I hope you don't mind me putting you on that list because I'd love to meet you and, you know, and say to you, come on, we got there and you got there. So look, will you keep the faith, as I say, and mind yourselves and tell the boys, I said to the toy man, said hello. And
well, they met you. Daniel has told me he met you. You were in his school this time last year, actually, in St. Tractus.
Come on.
Saying goodbye to the principal who was retiring.
That's right,
So they were so delighted because it was, I think it was declared Ryan Tubridy Day and they were never going to get homework on that day from there on
That's
in.
Right. Yeah.
But they're off now, so that doesn't count.
Oh, Lord. Okay, well, tell him I said hello. Yeah, I remember that well.
I will.
It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. And
you too.
I hope you get your snooze today and all the days. You deserve only the best things. And to you and all your colleagues in the hospital as well, please let them know that we appreciate everything you're doing, okay?
We will. Thanks a million, Ryan.
Okay, you're amazing. See you, Niamh.
Bye.
Thank you. Now, many of you, of course, will know of Philomena Lee, whose story was brought to the screen in the award-winning film Philomena. Philomena herself became pregnant at just 18 years of age. She was sent to Shanross Abbey in Roscrea, where she gave birth to her son, Anthony. They lived together for about 3.5 years when he was adopted out to a family in the United States. And she and Anthony, as Philomena has told us before, she spent many years looking for him and him for her, unbeknownst to each other. And by the time she found Anthony, he had passed away. Desperately sad story. story. But she does join me this morning on this very important day. This is the day that sees the publication we've been talking about of the report into the state's investigation into the mother and baby homes. And Philomena is joined on the line this morning by Susan Lowen, who's the co-founder of Adoption Rights Alliance. So we'll go to you, Susan, in a few minutes' time. But Philomena, let me start with you. Good morning to you and thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Ryan. Thank you very much indeed, anyway.
It's nice to talk to you again. You woke up this morning, Philomena, knowing that this report was going to be out. How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling, it seems that, Ryan, that everything has come back to me. Mind you, I've never lost the whole idea of my story, but it has come back to me full force this morning, you know. But as I say, in a way, I'm glad that it's come to the fore again, you know, that I feel it would bring back so many memories altogether.
And the idea of a commission of investigation, Philomena, was that important to you?
Well, it was, actually. I mean, it was very important to me because it did for me what I know a lot of other hundreds and hundreds of mothers that suffered like I did at the time, that maybe we'd be able to come out and give them the chance to be able to look for their babies and what have you, you know. So it's just that it's given them a chance so they can come forward and be able to find out so much about themselves that they were never given any information at all. We're just like myself, we're just at the deep end. I was there for 3.5 years and never had any information. But when after 3.5 years, to take my son away from me without just telling me, you know, that he just told me just before he went he was going to be adopted to America. Well, they told me that in June, 5 months before he was going to be adopted, but they didn't say where or why or anything. But there was no way I could do anything about that because my father at the time had disowned me. But the only one was my brother, my two sisters. I never did. But because of the shame of it all, Brian, I couldn't. My two sisters worked in Dublin, but they never knew where I'd gone over the 3.5 years. Dad didn't want to know because they asked Dad where I was, and he said he didn't want to know. Actually, I was dead to him, you know. But anyway, the only one was a brother of mine. But all the whole 3.5 years, I worked in the laundry there. Mm-hmm. It was very, very sad. Oh, sorry.
You take your time.
I was working in the laundry, and they sent for me. So I had to go up to the room. They said, there's somebody coming to pick your son up. I tell you, I was so shocked to think, in the beginning of it all. But then again, when I said there was a film made of it.
Yes.
And, you know, that when I saw the film, you know, sort of brought it all back again to me. It was so awful. And in the film, it actually happened the way it did. You know, there was one very nice young nun there, and she was very good to me all through the 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I had nobody visited me, except when I wrote, and when they told me that I was going to be adopted, I wrote to my dad, and my dad and my brother came in, to see me. My brother Toss, who was my ally really the whole way through. But anyway, I never had any visitors, I never had any money, I never had anything for the whole 3.5 years. But this nice little nun, she was good, and she, every time she'd, she was the head of the nurseries, and now and again she'd say, go in and have a look, go in and give him a cuddle or something like that. But anyway, apart from her, it was awful, you know. It was just day in, day out, half past 8 till 4 o'clock, laundry.
From the moment you were giving birth to Anthony, you were taunted by the nuns. You were mocked.
We were more or less really when I went into labour, because didn't know what it was like at all, you know. I didn't even know for the few months that I was pregnant, because you know how it happened, you know. Mm-hmm. When went to, oh, yeah, I had to leave the convent school. I went to convent school for 12 years. You were put into an orphanage when my mum died, because there were six of us, three boys and three girls, and, of course, Dad couldn't cope with it all. You know, he was only a young man himself at the time. Mm. And we were poor. I don't think we were that, you know, so we were put into a convent school in Limerick, Mount St. Vincent. And there we stayed for 12 and a half years. And then we had to leave there when we were 18, I think. So that's when I left, 18. And I went to stay with an aunt. There's an aunt in, that she lived in Limerick City. So I went to stay with her and worked for a few months with her. And she, like, you know, where I went to the show that night, the carnival, the first time I'd ever seen anything like it in my whole life, you know. So anyway, I went to met Anthony's dad and, you know, did the deed. Ryan, you know, and what have you, didn't know what it was all about.
No,
you know?
Of course
didn't
not.
Didn't have a clue what it was all about, you know. I look back and think, oh, what an idiot I was.
And Philomena, let me ask you.
Let
me ask you a question about being in the orphanage and the daily treatment to you. I mean, when you think of it, a lot of the women who gave birth to the children were snatched away immediately. You had this 3.5 years with Anthony.
I certainly did. Can you just imagine 3.5 years? And we used to work the laundry from 8:30 till 4 o'clock, and then we were allowed in for an hour to, you know, to play with our babies and have a chat with them and what have you. And then, as I say, life went on. I sort of, lots of things I can't half remember it. It was so bad, you know.
Of course.
It was so bad, you know. And then, as I say, day in, day out, clothes were off. We had to wear uniform things were off, things we had to wear. But there again, I suppose we just got used to it 3.5 years and loving him and doing everything I could, you know. The hour we used to spend with him, that I used to teach him little songs and little things about, our, you know, Irish things all in them days, you know. But the awful thing of 3.5 years and then just to be snatched away. And that's the, they say, come on, your son is going to be adopted. And just told me just like that. Well, I'll tell you. And it was a week before Christmas. And this last helper, I'll tell you, once he'd gone, I couldn't, the shock of it. It was the little nun, the nice little nun again. She said to me, your son is going today. And she ran me up the stairs. I mean, the end of the film was right, you know. She ran me, and I looked out, and I, God, I could not be seen going off in the car with this lady, you know. And
you spent so much of your life, as did Anthony, looking for each other.
Yeah, we did then. Over the years then, of course, we were absolutely more or less browbeaten that there was no way we were to tell our stories, keep it. And it was an awful shame all through those years, you know. The 3.5 years I was there. I mean, every time you went to confession, I mean, I don't have to say that, but every time we went to confession, you had to confess your sin. And we used, at the time, we were so such idiots, really, that we didn't realise that once you confessed it, it was supposed to be forgiven. But it never seemed to be forgiven, you know. It was always, when there was opportunities, they would say, now, you remember, you should be ashamed of yourself and all this kind of thing, having a baby like that. And, you know, this, we have got this from time to time, you know.
You gave your testimony, Philomena, to the commission. Can I ask you, was that a difficult experience for you or was it a helpful experience for you?
Well, I think it was a helpful experience, a very helpful experience. They taught me, I mean, I've probably forgotten some of it again, but the thing was, it was a very helpful, taught me things, I learned things that I hadn't really, had kind of pushed to the bottom of my mind, you know. It was a really helpful experience for me, you know.
And so, what do you think today, for example? I mean, obviously you haven't read the report, no one's read the report in its entirety that we know of, but it's out today. What will this mean, Philomena, for you, for the other girls who became the women who had to live with this story and their children? What is today about?
Today is about giving the other women, most of the other women as well, giving them the opportunity to be able to find out about the birth of their child also, because a lot of them can't get any of their records. A lot of them, there were no records at all, you know, sort of... over the years, so many of them have tried and tried and tried to get records, but they were never given to them. And this is what, this was one part of it, you know, the records of it. Access to the records. This is what they should get, really, access to, yes, the records. And also, sometimes I think, too, maybe there should have been maybe an apology, maybe from the church, or there should be an apology from the church, and also from... you know,
the government. We have an apology coming from the Taoiseach tomorrow, which I,
yeah,
I do.
Oh, you have, you, yeah, have. Well, I think from the Taoiseach, from the church, that that would help a little bit. I think, God, it would ease maybe some of the sadness and we had to go through, you know.
Susan,
I don't know if I'm able to get, and you saw how hard it was. It was awful, just and going through the whole of life. Then I went. Then when he was adopted, I cried all the whole. This was in the all the whole weekend and all Christmas. They took him away a week before Christmas,
yeah.
And then when he went, when they said, they used to tell me to shut up. I was making a nuisance of myself, you know, because I was all Christmas on my own, crying. And of course, they used to get fed up with me. I think I said, I wanted him back, and you can't have him back. And, you know, he should be grateful that he's gone to a good Catholic home, and, you know, this kind of thing. And then they got me a job. They called me up one day and they said, I was still working in the laundry then, and they said, you're going to get a job. We're sending you to England. You're going to get a job. And they sent me to another one of the branch of their nunnery, you know. They, mm-hmm, sent me there, and I worked there for 2 years, Liverpool. But for women today, I think they really, really need to be able to have access to the records, because, yeah, I think a lot of them are not able to get the records.
Well, let me put that to Susan Lowen, who's the co-founder of the Adoption Rights Alliance. Susan, is this a cathartic day?
Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning to you, and thank you for joining us. Is this a cathartic day for Ireland?
It is, and it's going to be a cathartic day for all of those people, the mothers, the children, who suffered huge human rights abuses in the mother and baby homes. But I'd like briefly to remember all of those mothers and children who won't be covered by this report,
yep,
because it doesn't cover any of the mothers who gave birth in state maternity hospitals or private nursing homes, but whose children were similarly taken for forced adoption.
Sure.
It won't cover the experiences of those children born to them, because essentially they were born in the wrong building.
And that is... It's probably a fight for another day, but in other words, the fight goes on. I mean, this is one battle won, but certainly the war for, no doubt, truth and reconciliation, if you like, continues.
Yeah, and I do hope that the findings of the commission are suitably robust. We don't want to be bogged down in the minutiae of, you know, the day-to-day routines necessarily of the women and children in those homes. We want to hear the commission referring to forced adoptions in Ireland, enforced disappearances, family destruction, social engineering, because this was a whole-scale industry funded, sponsored, monitored and regulated by the state through their agents, both the Catholic Church and also the Protestant churches, because we mustn't forget that the children who went through the Bethany homes suffered very similar fates, and in fact perhaps higher levels of neglect than those that went through the Catholic homes.
The language of today, it talks about human trafficking. The language,
yes,
then talked about finding good Catholic homes in America.
Yeah.
But if we were to apply today's language to history's actions, it's essentially whole-scale, dare I say it, state-sponsored human trafficking.
It absolutely is, and unless The commission has used that vocabulary, and if it hasn't, then the state needs to step up now and use that
yeah.
phraseology,
mm-hmm.
because anything else will be a diminishment of the experiences of the women. And in 1967, Ryan, 97% of all non-marital children were taken for adoption. So, I mean, that's social engineering at a scale almost unheard of anywhere else in the world.
Okay.
And people should not, they should not allow it to be described as women having given up their children for adoption or having abandoned them. In 20 years of talking to so many, you know, women and children affected by this, I have yet to meet a mother who voluntarily relinquished her child. The children were taken by and large for forced adoption.
Susan, thank you for joining us this morning on this momentous day in Ireland. And Philomena Lee, my old friend, it's been good to talk to you today. I hope that when you get your eyes on this report and as much of it as you can get through, that it's some cold comfort to you, because it's a long time coming, and you, as a representative of all the women listening this morning and their children and grandchildren, just want to say thank you. We're with you, we're thinking of you, and we hope you're all okay today.
Oh, thank you so much, Ryan. Thank you. I hope I've been some use anyway, you know.
Very much so.
But I'm so glad about it all. I'm glad it's all coming to the fore, you know. So much was hidden for years, you know, so...
Hopefully it's a brighter day today.
Yeah.
Philomena,
okay,
thank you so much. Lovely to talk to you again.
And you too as well. Have a good day yourself anyway, and all this, and Susan as well. Thank you, Susan, if you're able
good
to hear
talk
me.
To you again, Phil.
Okay, thank you both very much. Thank you, Philomena Lee, joining us on the radio this morning. Susan Lone, co-founder of Adoption Rights Alliance, also joining us on this morning of mornings. In some ways, it is an extraordinary day in terms of the country's history, and in some ways, as I say, the rug has been lifted and we're looking underneath, and it's not pretty. In fact, it's very hard to take, and by all accounts, it's going to be quite hard to stomach. But it's important, and it's healthy to be looking at it in some regards, and certainly to be talking about it. So, Susan, thank you, but particularly Philomena Lee, obviously, with her story so familiar to us. We appreciate her taking the time to talk to us this morning. The text number is 51551. 50 years ago, legendary television host David Frost interviewed the most influential thinkers and politicians and cultural icons of their time. Most of these tapes, though, were lost for a generation, until now, because David's son, Wilfred Frost, has followed in his father's footsteps to broadcasting. And after rediscovering the long lost tapes, he now invites listeners to join him on a deep dive, as they say in America these days, into his father's archive to explore the newly unearthed footage on his podcast series, The Frost Tapes. I was listening to it over Christmas, got really into it. And that's why I was very happy to say, let's get Wilfred on the program to talk us through it. Wilfred, good morning. And thanks for getting up for us at this unseemly hour. Nice to talk to you.
Very good morning to you from New York. My pleasure.
Before we talk about the Frost tapes, I'd like to talk about your father for a few minutes, because a lot of our listeners would have been very familiar with your dad throughout the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s and beyond. But how would you describe your dad as a broadcaster?
Wow, that's a very interesting first question. I mean, firstly, as a dad, he was just the best dad all round. As a broadcaster, I would say he just adored what he did. And in fact, growing up, he always said to my brothers, you've got to find something you love or you won't be fully, you know, committed to it. And I think top of the list within the many facets of broadcasting that he operated in was a fascination in people and exploring what made them tick. And you can't fake that, and you could see that really on all of the interviews that he did.
And what I find fascinating about it, and you know, even I was reminded of the varied and storied career he had watching Frost Nixon again recently for the second time, was that he really could turn his hand to anything. And one minute he could be talking to somebody about, you know, chasing sharks in the seas of Australia. The next he'd be talking to Richard Nixon. I mean, it was an extraordinary miscellaneous sort of career.
It was. And it started, of course, with comedy and satire. Yeah. And that was the week that was coming through. Like, in fact, we had something in the pipeline about a lot of more tapes that I've just discovered from where he was more a producer as opposed to in front of the camera and an interviewer. But again, I think it comes to a level of passion in a broad set of, you know, he also nearly became a professional soccer player, so he could interview the sports people, and he made films, so he could interview the film stars. And it kind of stopped short in one or two areas. Like, I remember when he went on Desert Island Discs and he said, this next song is for my sons, it's by Cold Play. So he didn't quite capture all areas, but almost all areas.
Indeed. And, you know, I met him once for about 2.5 seconds, and it was a very David Frost encounter because it was in a very nice hotel in Venice. And I'd never been there before, and I stopped him and I said, "You have no idea who I am." I said, "But I know who you are. I admire what you've done for living all down through the years, and I'm having a go at it myself over in Ireland." And he was a gentleman.
Well, it's always lovely to hear things like that, more so even than the plaudits of the shows themselves. And I think I have to say there were many examples of that, particularly, you know, when I do publicity for things like this and the number of people that are checking me in or lighting teams or cameramen who say, I had a chance to work with your dad once, and he was always the nicest, most down-to-earth man, which means a lot, actually. It's very, very nice to hear.
Because you obviously you loved your dad, and in your childhood with your brothers, and you got the sense that your dad was able to very comfortably mix business and pleasure. I mean, those legendary parties. You must have been watching goggle-eyed as prime ministers and presidents and their entourages came through the back garden.
Well, I think much to the dismay of some of those people is we didn't quite realise who they were, which I think is testament to the way that Dad did seamlessly mix the two. And, you know, he had his big annual summer party with 500-plus people, which I think grabbed the headlines. But clear in my memory were his more regular Sunday lunches. He had a Sunday morning show at that time, so his sort of main weekend get-together was a Sunday lunch as opposed to a Friday dinner or whatever. Mm-hmm. And 15, 20 people, and we'd all go and play football in the back garden afterwards. And, you know, no jokes aside, prime ministers and presidents kicked a football around with us, which is extraordinary. Tony Blair was comfortably the best and most competitive.
How was George Bush Sr.?
Bush Sr. was, again, just because he was such a warm and lovely man, played because he knew we wanted to play as 7 or 8 year olds, which was when he came. But so he was adept, but I don't think it was a passion, whereas Tony and Dad would do a clash on an interview in the Sunday morning, but I think they took the Frost v. Blair football match much more seriously in the afternoon.
Tell me about your dad's work rate. He didn't seem to stop. He was crisscrossing across the globe doing programmes at one stage, and he had this insatiable appetite for work by the looks of things. Is that true, or is that just looking at it from afar?
No, absolutely true. His work rate was prolific, and it goes back to what I said, I think, at the top. He just lived for it. He had a hobby, which happened to be his job. And when we were immediately all three graduating from university and getting our first serious jobs, none of us actually found a job that we loved straight away. And I remember being quite downbeat, thinking, you know, Dad, you're unique. Not many people get to find a job that they love. Thankfully, I managed to make a pivot and do it myself. But I think that's rare. And that's why he worked flat out from 22 to when he sadly passed at 74.
That was a very young age, particularly in the modern era, for a man like your dad, who, by all accounts, was a very healthy man, to pass away. Can I ask you about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, he certainly lived life to the max, and he enjoyed his cigars and his red wine and so on and so forth. But you're absolutely right in saying that he was very healthy. He had annual checkups and no signs whatsoever. So this absolutely came as a total shock to the family, and he died suddenly and unexpectedly, and there's nothing that prepares you for that. I was fortunate enough to lose my brother 2 years later, and I think there's an added aspect of that someone who's only a year older than you, it comes as even greater shock. But with Dad, the same applied. I thought he still had 2 decades left, and there's so many of those things when it happens, you think, gosh, I didn't speak to him about this, I didn't ask him about that. I thought I had years to come.
Isn't it amazing how the best laid plans absolutely waste of time in some ways? And yet, your brother, Miles, was he 31, Wilfred?
He was, and it's, it honestly, I'm sitting here at my desk, I have a picture of each of them in front of me, and that it actually amazes me to think that Dad was 7 years ago, 7.5 years ago, Miles was 5.5 years ago. Just nuts to think that we've lived that much of life now without them. And Miles died suddenly, and even more unexpectedly, from a heart condition we didn't know he had. In fact, Dad had that heart condition, as his post-mortem identified, though it wasn't what caused his death. And so Miles's death had an added tragedy in that it was very avoidable. And he had a condition called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy and died whilst out sprint training, and shouldn't have been sprint training if he'd known he had the condition. So it was, again, an added tragedy to see that. And that's why we work with the British Heart Foundation and set up the Miles Frost Fund to try and make sure others don't go through similar fate.
Of course. And you and your brother got yourselves, I presume, checked out immediately.
We did. And George and I are fine. So the world of sprinting is still able to have us participate.
So when you go through, like your father interviewed 8 prime ministers, 7 US presidents in office, and you've got over 10,000 interviews, and you're going through, like, if most people, when their father died, there's some boxes and there's some clothes. You're sitting there with 10,000. You've got depots everywhere. Your dad seemed to have been, thankfully, an archival hoarder, which is a compliment. And it must have been poignant and sort of beautiful.
Yes, but both, I mean, and incredibly dusty. but yes, there was a whole storage depot I didn't know about initially in Cleveland. Mm. I mentioned at the start of each episode, I knew about the ones in London, New Jersey, and 2 in LA. And then we later discovered the one in Cleveland, which is where the lost Biden interview was found, which I'm sure we'll come to. But I think that two main opportunities that this podcast presented and took so long to kind of get to was A, he was a hoarder, but B, the sort of digital age passed him by. He was such an innovator behind the camera and television for the first 30 years of his 50-year career. But the last 20, you know, that the opportunity was, none of this stuff was out there and on YouTube and digitalized. So particularly that stuff in the 60s and 70s that we focus on in the podcast, once we got the tapes, which weren't in great condition, and digitalized them, that was the only copy out there. These things hadn't been exploited, like, for example, the Nixon interview has, and available on YouTube. So I think, you know, that's why so much of this podcast, well over half, is lost for a generation, because it aired once and that was it.
We'll get to Nixon in a minute. I want to ask you briefly about... So Michael Sheen played your father. He also played Tony Blair, your dad's mate in some ways, and opponent in the movies. You were a little bit uncertain at first about Michael's interpretation of your father. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I think when all of that happened, I was about 20 when the play came out. Of course, it went on to be a movie as well. It was a sort of 3-year period in our early 20s. It was wonderfully good fun. Particularly for Dad. And I think as his son, you know very clearly your image of Dad. And this wasn't exactly the same as how I thought Dad was. Very rare, of course, situation when you ever see anyone impersonate your dad to that extent. When I've gone back and watched all these tapes in the 60s and 70s as Michael Sheen is portraying a dad, I actually think it's pretty spot on, and fair play to Michael. I think he did a great job, and he was absolutely charming throughout, as I said, what was a 3 or 4 year period, because he played Dad on the West End, Broadway, and then in this movie.
Mm. And one of the things that I was a bit confused about when I was listening to your podcast, The Frost Tapes, is the sense that the portrayal, as we were told, was that Nixon had no idea who this upstart TV guy is, whereas actually he'd known all about him.
Known all about him, and Dad had interviewed him before in 1968. And I've joked with Peter Morgan, who wrote and created Frost Nixon, with this since. I think there was a couple of storylines. Dad at the time felt this too, which he exaggerated for dramatic effect.
Yeah,
one was playing up, you know, a David versus Goliath type aspect, which you can understand. The other, which was a little perhaps more frustrating, was as if Dad stumbled across this apology by luck at the end of the interview, which I'm glad, by sounds of what you're saying, you see when you listen to the episode Frost Nixon Revisited, the final episode, you see is very much not the case. This was every aspect of interviewing, preparation, and of the personability that Dad had that perhaps Woodward and Bernstein, had they been in the seat at the time, would not have had. And it all came together to be you know, I'm biased, but I think, you know, the ultimate display of interviewing perhaps of all time.
I would agree with you. And, you know this from Closing Bell and CNBC and in your role as an anchor or presenter, as we say here. And I know a bit about it myself on TV here too, which is that you look at the likes of your father and Dick Cavett and other presenters of yesteryear, where they had 45 minutes, maybe a whiskey, certainly a packet of cigarettes, and they got down to business. That length of time that a presenter had, an interrogator with the guest, gosh, it's the envy of every presenter now, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I joked, I interviewed Vice President Pence, who would be a particularly good interview right now, but yeah. For a few times earlier in the year, and we were given 10 minutes and I stole 14, and you get uproar from the comms people afterwards, and you know that, you know, you're not going to get another one for 6 months because of that. And as you say, he always secured, and for the David Frost show, he would, which is a large part of what features in the archive, you know, he would give people like the leader of the Black Panthers, Huey Newton, or you know, women's rights activists, Shirley Chisholm and others, the whole show. 90 minutes, which even back then was exaggerating the position you're referring to. And that leads to the chance to have these revealing personal life philosophy interviews that you know, it's much harder to come by in a shorter space of time. Of course, the Nixon interviews were 28 hours, which will never be repeated. But he paid for that. I mean, he paid exclusively through the nose for that right, which I always find... The argument of checkbook journalism takes much longer time. It's a fair criticism on one level. But had Dad not done that, he wouldn't have had the time. He wouldn't have had in writing that 4 hours had to be about Watergate. And America probably would never have got the apology that Dad elicited.
That's extraordinary. One of the things that people probably don't know about when you're doing a program the way you might do or I might do is that when you're getting ready for an interview that's pre-recorded particularly, you have a chat with the person you're talking to. And in those 3 minutes, microphones being put on, makeup checks, hair, make sure everyone's okay. Those 3 minutes of small talk can often make or break the nature of the following 15 to 20 minutes, because you will either warm to somebody or it might go frosty, excuse the expression, under the circumstances. But you know what I mean? It could just go cold and suddenly it's not pleasant. But if that small talk at that point is strong enough, it can make for a great encounter.
Oh, absolutely. And he was the master at that. And, you know, that's where it comes back to that he was super sociable and all those parties. And people wanted to be around Dad. They adored him because he was so genuine and interested in them and so fun and charismatic. And I think he was the natural at that small talk before things getting started. And we reveal some of that off-camera stuff.
Yes.
In the podcast, particularly with the Nixon interviews.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the annoying thing from the tapes is they tend to pick up 2 minutes before the recording session, not, and run for 2 minutes afterwards, not 10, 20 minutes. And one or two of the conversations get cut off. And I'm sitting there being like, I wanted to hear what came after that. But fascinating stuff, which, features in the podcast.
Let's take a flavor of that. This is Nixon and your father... Getting microphoned up, and the small talk falls into the area of pretty much beer. Have a listen.
More alive.
That's right, yes.
I don't like it. I don't like any of it. And beer, I can't. I used to like beer in a boat, but blows you up too much.
Oh, it does. Although Harold Wilson, strangely enough, is on a
beer diet.
Yeah. But I don't see how that works.
That was all.
How does that work? Because it inflates everybody else.
I mean, that's all, you know, that Randolph Churchill drank at the end. Yeah. I never forget. I met him at his club. Was white.
Oh, we're on, are we? Are we on? Sorry, forgive me.
Five,
Andrew.
Four. Three,
we'll come back to Randolph later.
God, you know, Wilfred, you want to hear what happened. I can feel your frustration. I go, cut that interview.
Well, no, the thing I love about that is A, that Dad's, we're on, are we?
Yeah.
I mean, just as if he had no idea, but also that he was aware what Harold Wilson's drinking habits were.
Yes.
He just had these relationships. I can also reveal exclusively, Ryan, that he was not a beer drinker himself. He preferred a nice Bordeaux or Burgundy.
Yes.
But it's just a brilliant exchange there.
Well, probably not unlike, again, Tony Blair. He was able to chameleonize himself into a conversation to suit the guest at hand.
Yes, exactly. But the other clip
Yeah.
Which got a bit of pickup here, actually, on that, is there's a moment where Nixon says, oh, I want to say something. Are the tapes off, David? And Dad's like, cut the tapes. I want to say something about Mitchell, referring to his attorney general, yes, which has never been said. And then it cuts, and we don't know what he said.
Oh, lads. Oh, God, it's the frustration of it. But what I want to talk to you about in this week of weeks, we're hours almost away from the inauguration of Joe Biden. We are days away from the, can we say, insurrection on Capitol Hill? I mean, the mind continues to buy in the middle of a pandemic. And yet, the reason I'm mentioning this is because when I was listening to your podcast and listening to the point where your dad asks Richard Nixon about the media and the profoundly extraordinary echoes of history between Nixon and media and the, for now, current incumbent of the White House on media is breathtaking.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm going to play that now. Were you struck by that, obviously, when you were putting it together?
Oh, absolutely. And I would say I've had a few attempts, but it took me a few years to get the ducks in a row, but 2018, 2019, of getting a project of this ilk together that never quite got off the ground until this year's version. And both times, front and center of the pitch was the quotes of Nixon on media that I just felt, oh my gosh, this could be taking place today. And this is a part of the archive that's overlooked. This is a part of the most famous interview of all time that people haven't focused on. And that's kind of, I guess, is the essence of the podcast as a whole. But I agree that the comments on media feel like they could be coming out of the mouth of today's president.
And here they are.
The greatest concentration of power in the United States today is not in the White House. It isn't in the Congress. And it isn't in the Supreme Court. It's in the media. And it's too much. Because it is too concentrated in too small a circle. When you look at with that concentration of power, let me say, particularly in the television area, in the networks, it's too much. It's too much power, and it's power that the founding fathers would have been very concerned about, because the founding fathers balanced the power. The presidency balances, the Congress balances, the Supreme Court. And when you have balanced power, you have checks, each on the other. There is no check on the networks. There is no check on the newspapers. Now, understand, I am not advocating censorship, but I would advocate, for example, proliferation. I would advocate cable television. I would advocate, and I do stand for, the right of a president, a vice president, or a member of Congress, instead of taking an unmerciful beating and an unfair beating from network commentators or columnists in newspapers, if they are important, to have the right to fight back in the same medium, be given equal time. I think he should. And I think it's nonsense and hypocritical, frankly, for those in the media, after they dish it out, to say, oh, he's trying to destroy freedom of the press, he's trying to repress us, because now and then he says a story is inaccurate or a story is unfair.
Now, Wilfred Frost, I mean, that is the, if you replaced networks with Facebook or Twitter, it is remarkable.
It totally is. And, you know, the media episode is one of my favorites, being a broadcaster myself. I think there's just so many aspects to it. I think, weirdly, we've kind of gone full circle in that, of course, back then when Nixon was talking, the fairness doctrine, which is, I guess, the equivalent of what, well, in the United Kingdom anyway, the of Ofcom regulations exists, and the FCC fairness doctrine still existed. It was repealed late 80s in the Reagan era, which then led to the proliferation of cable news and the way in which that can be biased, perhaps, in the way that print media can in the UK. And then, of course, social media came afterwards, which probably made it worse. And, this last week has been pretty extraordinary. But weirdly, you've had the social media companies make the decision to restrict the president, rather than kind of the opposite, which is what Nixon was talking about, and some of the phrases that I would say, echoed a lot of the Trump presidency in the preceding 4 years.
Amazing. That brings us on to the presidential candidates, because that's what your father did. He spoke to a lot of the people who may or may not ultimately get to the White House. And in 1987, I think he came last in that race for the nomination, at least, was one Joseph Biden.
Well, indeed, but I don't even think he came last. He just had to pull out before we got to that point because of accusations of plagiarism. In part, was probably the main reason why he had to pull out. But exactly, so Dad did a show in '88 for the '88 election called The Next President with David Frost. Interviewed all 12 candidates, 6 Republicans, 6 Democrats. Biden was one of those 6 at the time. It was late '87 at the time he executed the interviews. But that particular interview, which was about 2 hours and 10 minutes in terms of raw tape, never aired because Biden, in fact, pulled out a week or two after it was interviewed. And that was one of the tapes that I didn't even know existed, sitting in Cleveland. And because it had never aired, there was just one copy, the master tapes. Very nearly got thrown out, and we got our hands on them a little while after Dad died. And, of course, the way time works, because we didn't get the show out earlier, it just had even more power and relevancy because suddenly this is a candidate Biden doing an interview wanting to be president. And even though it was recorded, 20, 30 years earlier, it felt like it could have been today itself because Dad did this sort of life philosophy, the personal style of interview rather than just what's the policy on this particular latest development in 1987.
Imagine. Well, let's take a clip of that. And I think the most striking thing about this clip is how young, obviously, Joe Biden sounds. But this is your father, Joe Biden, 1987.
I don't want to sound overly confident about it, but the degree of confidence I have about being able to compete in that arena is strong. I feel very good about that prospect. And I feel a sense of confidence because I have 15 years of experience as a United States senator. I have been tested in ways that many people have, and I feel like I have a sense of where I am, a knowledge of what I want to do, a vision for what I want to see this country become. But the harder test, David, is not the one, can I do it better than my opponent or my prospective opponent? The harder test, when everybody goes to bed and you're sitting in this library by yourself and you ask yourself, now, can I be the kind of president that I think America should have? Can I be the kind of president that Abraham Lincoln was? Can I be the kind of president Franklin Roosevelt was? Can I be a great president? And then you sit and think for a moment and beads of sweat pop out on your forehead, at least on mine, and you say, well, let me put that decision off to later. Let me just focus on why I'm better than the other guy. So there are two tests. And the one's much harder than the other.
Isn't time extraordinary, Wilfred?
I know. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And the other part of that interview, Dad gets him to talk about some of the other tragedies he'd experienced, of course, losing his first wife and his daughter. And in a way that in every documentary and every interview you've seen about him in the decades that followed, he was just not as open and genuine about. And I think that was very, very, very poignant. And then I think, people are right, as you kind of did in the intro, to see that he was very, very young, very, very charismatic and energetic and on point in a way that perhaps he is, as you would expect, many decades later. And I wasn't sure whether people would take that as a positive or a negative leading up, and I'm not sure for people to decide. But certainly the content of what he said, I think, overall came across quite well, people seem to think.
And of course, you can now say posthumously, at least, about your father, he interviewed 8 U.S. presidents who made it to the White House.
Well, it's actually 9.
Is it 9? Sorry, I missed one.
But I agree. No. Well, when he died, you're right. I think in your thought process there, we, of course, said 7 consecutive U.S. presidents, which already was an accolade that nobody would ever match.
Mm.
British or American, he was well ahead in that. But actually, he interviewed Donald Trump as well before he was president. On Through the Keyhole of all
shows. Oh, my goodness.
And 9 presidents.
Wow.
So 2, of course, before they became president. The Through the Keyhole episode, the interview, I would, don't tell Dad I said this, was fairly unremarkable. An amusing moment at the end when he hands him over the Through the Keyhole key and you can see Trump thinking, what on earth is this show I've just been on? But Lloyd Grossman touring what was then a private home of Mar-a-Lago in Florida is
is something worth watching. So there we go.
One of my favourite guests I've ever interviewed is John Cleese. Is it true that he's your godfather?
It is indeed. John Cleese was my godfather, and my little brother's godfather was Ronnie Corbett, and Dad. It's a very moving fact when you see what some of those characters, whether they were our godfather or not, had said about Dad. And Dad played a big role in their careers in the early days with some of his sketch shows like Frostbort and Last 1948 Show, which we produced, parodied and produced. So they were great friends of Dad's throughout. Now, John, I still catch up with when I can, when he's in New York. Of course, lockdown has prevented anything like that for quite some time. But no, John Cleese is a great man.
I have to say, it's been really fascinating to tiptoe through your dad's career and through those amazing tapes. And you've done a lovely job and a great keeper of the flame of your father's memory, Wilfred, if you don't mind me saying so, with that lovely podcast. It's meaningful and thoughtful. And there's a lovely father-son vibe running through it as well. So I wish you well in your own broadcasting career. And thank you for taking the time to talk to us this morning. Great to talk to you.
Ryan, truly my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's cool. Now, that's Wilfred Frost. And Wilfred's podcast, The Frost Tapes, is available wherever you get your podcasts. 8 episodes ready available there. And thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyable listen and highly recommended. And really enjoyed that conversation with Wilfred Frost. The text number is always 51551. Now, from the Bayside to Amsterdam, let us go and say good morning to Dr. Caro Verbeek, who has a fascinating job. Good morning, Caro.
Good morning.
Nice to talk to you. Yeah, likewise. You have an intriguing job. Could you tell us your job description, please?
Well, I call myself a scent historian.
Yes.
I was trained as an art historian, but specialised in the sense of smell in history.
And yet, how can we understand smelling and history? What, how do you link the two?
Well, of course, there always has been smells,
yes,
in the past, and they tend to fade because scents are volatile. But they're still part of our material heritage, part of our identity of certain groups of people. Think of church masses and rituals or diets, etc. And we can retrieve these scents and also study how people experienced these scents. There are different ways. Of course, you can look at texts, at sources,
mm-hmm,
at recipes for certain medicines or perfume. But you can also, and this is only for the past century, talk to nose witnesses, so people who have actually smelled things that are not here anymore. For example, people who experienced the war, different cleaning products, so you can talk to people. And then there's another way, which can be described as molecular archaeology.
Yes.
So let's say you find a bottle, can be thousands of years old, a perfume bottle, and you take a sample from the inside, even though the perfume has gone. You can still analyze the perfume that was once present by analyzing the molecules that were once inside, and that way you can reconstruct a scent. Or, and this is the most exciting part, mm-hmm, if you ask me, some scents never lose their smell. So you can smell resins, for example, such as frankincense and myrrh. Those are resins from trees. They keep their scents for centuries. And that's so exciting. That really gives you this a sense of being in direct contact with the past.
You know, we hear about oral history a lot, but nasal history is a different league altogether. But I'd love you to tell me about some of the smells you've recreated for the Rijksmuseum project in search of lost scents.
Yeah, oh, that was so exciting. Mm. That was a collaboration with the Rijksmuseum, of course, and also IFF, International Flavors and Fragrances. And they have a lot of noses. So expert perfumers that know exactly how to replicate certain smells. And we reconstructed the Battle of Waterloo.
How?
The Battle of Waterloo with Birgit Sijbrands. This was an endeavor. First, we studied sources, written sources, and because of those sources, we know that it was very rainy And that has an effect on the smells, wet earth, wet grass, wet everything. And we also know the perfume that Napoleon wore that day, which was very similar to 4711 Eau de Cologne, which we still know.
And what class of cologne was he wearing?
Well, it was in his days, this was called Aqua Mirabilis. Mm-hmm. Miracle water. So in his days, it was still considered a medicine. But it's very similar to the eau de cologne that is still sold today in Cologne and all over the world, called 4711, which is very citrusy. It has rosemary, so it's incredibly fresh. And this freshness was very adequate because it could really mask or fight the evil stench of the battlefield.
So if I go to the, if I was going to the museum as part of a tour and you gave me a necklace with tiny pumps in it and I was looking at different things to do with the Napoleonic Wars, what would happen?
We studied this. We actually observed tour guides and groups of people that worked with these scents, and we asked them questions afterwards. The first thing that happens, people feel much more immersed. They feel as if they're part of a painting instead of just looking at a painting. It becomes so much more realistic. The smell of horses was also in this composition. And some people said that they could see the horses moving.
Really?
Yeah, so because it becomes so much more realistic. What also happens is that they stay much, much longer. They just want to stay there. They want to soak up the scent. They want to see how this scent is connected to the painting. So in general, on average, people look at paintings a few seconds.
Mm.
If you bring a smell, they look minutes because they want to see how the smell and the painting are connected.
It's such an amazing idea. The idea of going to see a beautiful painting in the National Gallery in Dublin or whatever museum it might be, and just standing there with these smells coming through your nostril, it must be like breathtaking.
Literally breathtaking indeed, yeah.
Okay, you know, you've said that wars are extremely smelly, all wars, and you make a brilliant point that soldiers, when you read diaries and so on, soldiers don't necessarily talk about as much about injuries or indeed psychological scars. They talk about the sounds, but also the smells.
Absolutely, yeah. So when we look at paintings or read books, we don't necessarily think of these smells. Indeed, in diaries, soldiers write about the awful, traumatic, loud noises, the impact of bombs and whatnot more, and also the horrible, horrible smells. And of course, they had to develop strategies to fight these smells, which is why soldiers for hundreds of years bring perfume to the war zones. I think they still do, actually.
Yeah.
And you can, if you want to be really effective, you bring your partner's perfume so you can mask the evil smells and at the same time think of the comforting, the memory of home.
Yeah, and bring the and marry the two smells in some ways.
Yeah.
This is an odd question and it's not meant to be facetious, but you'll know this is your field in a manner of speaking. Does sweat smell differently depending on the circumstances of the sweating?
Oh, yes, yeah, this is really intriguing. Several factors influence the way your sweat smells.
Really?
Yeah, for example, your diet. I once, for a TV program, sniffed the armpits of meat eaters versus vegetarians. You can smell it. One is not necessarily more attractive than the other one, by the way. But anxiety sweat is very different. Because, and this is a recent insight, anxiety sweat is produced by different glands in your armpits.
Mm-hmm.
So a very different smell. And it's also dependent on the bacteria, the colonies of bacteria in your armpits. Mm. People have different bacteria there. And some smell really pungent and others smell much more weak. And it's really the type of bacteria living there.
You recreated, I think it was the Amsterdam Stock Exchange, to try and get a flavour of that 17th, 18th century. And what I'm trying to figure out is, where, Caro, do you go to try and bring people back there in a sense through scent?
Well, Well, this was actually a reconstruction by Inger Lehmann, project leader of Oud Europa. And she did this with Jorgen Benius from Iceland. But you can bring back smells in all kinds of places. I prefer museums because museums are places of objects, of visual inputs, which you can then connect to other senses. So you get a very wholesome sensory story. But you can also, and we did this, do this in a theater, and work with an aroma jockey to diffuse scents throughout the audience with large electrical fans and cooking plates. You can virtually bring smells back to the noses of the audience everywhere.
But on the stock exchange that you didn't do, but just I was just intrigued that they could get the notes of fresh air or river water from the particular, from the Amstel, and then sweat and musk and get that sense on the floor, the wood, the stone, maybe hints of nutmeg and clove because that's what the merchants were. I can see how fascinating. It's kind of like it's an archaeology of the nose, like you were saying, and the excitement of trying to get that right. So if we go a bit closer to home in terms of time, and we're very familiar in this country, Caro, with the Euro 88 championship, and for you, you wanted to recreate the Dutch football team's dressing room.
Yeah.
Where do you begin?
Yeah, first of all, I tried to find a nose witness, so one of the people on the team, and I found Adrie van Tichelen, and he was prepared to talk to me, and I asked him all kinds of questions because it's hard for people to remember smells.
Yes.
When you smell something, it's easy. It easily transports you back in time. But it's very hard to think of smells from the past.
I asked him
all kinds of questions.
Yeah.
What kind of deodorant did you use? What kind of showering gel? What were the different materials? And then he told me, well, of course, there was the smell of leather. There was the smell of grass. And when the grass was moist, the smell was much, much stronger. There was the smell of smelly feet when the guys took off their socks before they took a shower. Mm. But they also used eau de cologne, different eau de cologne. They used a showering gel called Badedas, very 80s. a fresh up deodorant.
Yes.
And then some of the guys used a lot of oil for their skin to moisten their skin, and champagne.
And champagne.
Champagne.
And, yeah. and maybe a little coconut oil.
A little coconut oil for to moisten the skin. Lots of different smells. And, an interesting fact is that Hans van Breukelen, the goalkeeper, he is said to, before the game, to have left an olfactory souvenir in the locker room of the other team, the Russians. So
what does that mean?
Well, he took a shit in the dressing room of the Russians.
Sorry, I was not expecting that. Your English is perfect, Carol.
Oh, thank you.
Is that it? You're just going to leave that there in a manner of speaking?
Yeah, well, that's thank what you. He did. And I call it an olfactory souvenir. I wanted to sound chic, but then I had to say that he took a shit.
I did ask you, and I have to say, an olfactory souvenir is an expression I will now never forget as a result of our conversation this morning. I'm absolutely enriched by that contribution to our conversation this morning, no question about it. Ruud Gullit, or as you probably call, I presume you pronounce it Ruud Gullit.
Ruud
Gullit. He had his own smell.
Yeah, well, apparently Adrie van Tichelen told me that he smelled of coconut oil.
And that would be what, to do with the dreadlocks or something?
Yeah, maybe. I have no idea,
sure.
Actually. I should get into this further.
No, that's okay. I don't wanna, let me ask you about older people, maybe for older residents with dementia. And what can... We've talked about this before, like the singer Glen Campbell and how he could remember songs, and people with Alzheimer's can often remember songs, but then couldn't remember something that happened 10 minutes ago. Do smells have the same? Can smells spark lucidity?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Even more so if we have to believe researchers, very specialized researchers, then smells can do this even better than music. Because it's located, our olfactory bulb, our smell brain, is located at the center of our brain, in our primitive brain, right next to where we store memories. So the difficulty is, of course, that we can easily look up songs from the past and play songs from the past, but it's very hard to find the smells that were important in the childhoods of people now suffering from dementia. Another problem is that people who suffer from this illness also have their sense of smell has diminished. So it's harder for them to smell things. So maybe with more intense smells and a bit of research into their past, what if they engaged in horseback riding? Then you should bring the smell of horses. What if they lived in the countryside? Then you have to try to replicate that smell for them. And then it can take them back to their childhoods.
That's a really lovely idea, I think, if you were to have somebody in your life with dementia that you might, you know, put cloves in an orange and see if it sparks a memory of Christmas for your childhood or something.
Yeah, that would be beautiful. Yeah, it works for some people. Yeah. Mm,
okay. Are there smells, Carol, today in 2021 that are starting to fade?
Well, maybe not today, but I think in 10 years' time, we will all have electrical cars.
Mm.
So that means that the streets will smell very differently, not just because of the lack of car exhaust, but also because other smells will become stronger. And we already noticed this, at least here in the Netherlands, during the first lockdown. There was less traffic, and spring smelled more fragrant than ever. Yeah. We could smell things from much further away.
Yeah, that's for sure. And equally, you presume when horses started to be replaced by cars, the smell of the streets with horse olfactory gifts must have been pretty intense.
Pretty intense. And we forget, okay, now there's car exhaust, but when we still used horses and carriages, think of all the manure, the urine that was the car exhaust.
Have its day. What does the pandemic smell like, Carol?
It has many smells, and lack of smells, of course. What I noticed was people use a lot of hand sanitizer, and they use bleach, much more bleach. It makes people feel safe at home when everything smells clean. But of course, because of Corona, a lot of people also suffer from anosmia, or smell blindness, and this is also happening, parosmia. Parosmia means that smells become distorted, which might be even a bigger nightmare than losing your sense of smell, because suddenly everything smells awful. No matter if you smell a rose or coffee, it all smells like, well, what they told me was baby diapers.
You know what? I was only talking to a medical person last night who told me that one of the awful outcomes of COVID for people who lost their smell is to get this other thing that you just described, where you not only do you not have you lost your smell as such, but you smell, as you say, almost like fecal matter, and that's your given olfactory sense. That's just appalling as a thought.
It's appalling. It's a nightmare, and it causes depression. You cannot enjoy life anymore if everything smells so bad.
And is there a talk of a cure for that, or is that something you can manage? Or
well, yes, there is this training people can follow. You have to sniff 4 very different odorants every day.
Okay.
For example, eucalyptus, clove, ammonia, and smell those every day, and then somehow your receptors, in some cases, can regenerate.
Kathleen was listening this morning, Carol. She says, we did a session of scent therapy in a daycare for Alzheimer's. And I'd say now it's about 6 years ago. They had little bottles of scents, for example, the smell of cut grass, shoe polish and so on. And it was lovely for the clients to guess the smells. And it brought back lovely memories associated with that scent. Smell and music are used to create a memory. And if you think of it, it's so true. That's a lovely thing to do for people in that situation. Another famous Irish chef, Kevin Thornton, reproduced the smell of the sea for his scallop dish he served with sea mist and seaweed at his restaurant to bring people to the sea and evoke memories, said Saoirse. So that's a very clever and nice, interesting thing to do. Another says from Maeve, says, following the death of a loved one, the smell from their clothes becomes really precious. I still have a dress that my mother wore before she died and I will never wash it. I hug it every so often and I still shed a few tears, but it helps me feel closer to her.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, it's a lovely thing to think about. And Aileen says, I use 4711 all the time. If I have a headache, I put it on my forehead and it works to clear. Also, when not well, I just spray it all around me. And I think that Caro has just confirmed the healing properties of that Napoleonic scent for me. Caro, you have the most intriguing job, I have to say. And I really appreciate you sharing your time with us this morning. We might talk again, depending on the nature of the world. So thank you for your time.
You're very welcome.
All the best. That's Dr. Caro Verbeek, who is a Dutch art and scent historian, and I was flabbergasted by that, I have to say. Really, really intriguing person, and what a story.